Most marketplaces tend to be a winner-take-all, winner-take-most, you know, situation. And as they start abusing their monopoly power, then that catches the attention of, you know, in the case of the U.S., Congress has investigated Amazon significantly.
Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast for 6-, 7-, and 8-figure Amazon and e-commerce sellers, part of the amazing FBA podcast family. If you want to scale fast, target a 7-figure exit, and enjoy the process, then keep listening. Do you want to grow your business bigger and faster? A free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find missed golden opportunities. I generally charge $150 or more per hour, but this would be free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing a few thousand dollars a month in sales already. Just visit myamazonaudit.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit, and book in a time. That's myamazonaudit.com. Look forward to speaking to you on your audit. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome back to the 10K Collective podcast. It's a place to be for those who are e-commerce sellers and particularly for those who sell on Amazon. Now, today's guest is a bit different. Shirish Nadkarni has written a book, Winner Takes All, which is all about marketplaces and particularly, as the name implies, how they tend towards monopoly, which if you sell on Amazon is obviously something you really need to be aware of the environment you're in. He's a serial entrepreneur, very successful guy, and advises startups as well. So, Shirish, welcome to the show, first of all.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. So, give us a potted history, 60 seconds, about who Shirish Nadkarni is.
Well, I'm a native of Seattle. I've been in the tech business for over 30 years. Started my career at Microsoft in the early days of MS-DOS, as it was known, and then Windows. I did the acquisition of Hotmail for Microsoft. And then in 2000, I started my entrepreneurial journey. I've had 3 different startups, 2 successful exits, and I now advise and invest in startups. I try to give back to the startup ecosystem. I've written a number of books, Winner Takes All, and then also From Startup to Exit.
Amazing. From Startup to Exit also sounds like a very interesting book. We'll have to get you back on to talk about that. But this is really quite an unusual book in the sense that many, many people advise on how to sell on marketplaces, but not many people talk about the dynamics of the marketplaces themselves. So we're going to split this into 2 episodes. The first one, we're going to talk about the marketplace dynamics as a seller. And then the second one, an opportunity that I don't see many people doing, but I've known a couple of people in my time, of actually creating your own marketplace, which sounds a bit too crazy for most people. It's more big thinking. But first of all, let's focus in this episode on understanding marketplace dynamics. I think that's the key thing. So we're in the marketplace. We've got to understand the environment we're hunting in, as it were. So Winner Takes All is obviously a very clear title. You clearly believe that marketplaces are destined to become monopolies. And why is that the case?
Yeah, so what's interesting about marketplaces is that they are extremely challenging to get off the ground because, you know, if consumers come and they know suppliers, you can't consummate a transaction and vice versa. If you have suppliers but no consumers, the same thing happens. But once you get beyond that and you establish a critical mass of suppliers and consumers, the network effects kick in. And as more suppliers join the network or the marketplace, more consumers are attracted to it. And as more consumers are attracted to the marketplace, more suppliers are attracted to it. So it becomes a virtuous cycle. And then you end up, you know, growing very fast, like, you know, eBay, Amazon, Alibaba, all these great examples. And ultimately, it's a winner takes all, a winner takes most kind of business opportunity.
Yeah, it's interesting. So you reference in your book eBay, which is probably the most famous early network effects and marketplace, rather, that we all know. And very interesting that even the mighty Amazon went to try and compete directly with eBay and failed because even though they were free and eBay charged at the time, right? So I guess this goes to show it's not just about money. It's about if you turn up somewhere and you want to sell, you need to know that you've got a good set of buyers. And likewise, if you want to go shopping, you need to know that you've got more than 3 sad little things left in the corner, like sort of late communist era shopping. So yeah, it's very, very interesting. Now, another thing that you mentioned is called multi-tenanting. So what is that and how is that important?
So multi-tenanting means that as a supplier, you can be on multiple marketplaces at the same time. And if multi-tenanting is possible, then it becomes harder for a marketplace to become a winner-take-all situation. So a good example would be, Uber and Lyft. You know, a lot of drivers, will have both apps, Uber and Lyft, running simultaneously on their phone while they're waiting for a ride. And whoever, contacts them first, saying, here's a ride, would you like to take it? They will then take that. And so that's why Lyft is not a winner-take-all, but, Lyft is also a strong player in the U.S. because they're able to do, drivers are able to multi-tenant between Uber and Lyft at the same time.
Yeah, a lot of people use the sort of pitch for their business. It's the Uber of X. And I always think, I don't find that a very attractive proposition because I don't think Uber has ever made a profit, as I understand it. Now, I get the fact that to create a giant monopoly type business, you're going to have to trade market penetration for profit in the first few years. Yes. But I don't see a path to profit for Uber personally. I don't have any qualifications to know enough about the business to know whether that's the case. But you just put your finger on why. I think in Britain, Uber and Bolt are the ones that I would personally use as a consumer. Never used it as a driver. Of course, I don't drive cabs at least yet. Things haven't got that bad, but I personally see cheaper prices appearing on Bolt. And there isn't really anything at all to keep me with Uber. And there's a couple of random additions that have nothing to do with the core business for me, which don't attract me at all. It keeps offering to buy me train tickets, but I can buy those from the train company. So it's interesting how even really massive venture-backed and hugely funded things can still hit this problem. Now, let's talk about e-commerce and multi-tenanting for a minute. So I guess it's a bit different, isn't it? Let's explore this. So e-commerce sellers often sell on Amazon, of course, and eBay and Walmart. Would you say that's a comparable situation to the Uber, Lyft or Uber and Bolt phenomenon, or is it different? And if so, why is it different?
Yeah, it is different. Amazon has over 2 million sellers, whereas, Walmart has only about 50,000 or so sellers on their platform. And the reason that you don't have multi-tenanting really happening in that market space is because it takes quite a lot of energy to be on a specific platform. So if you want to sell really well on Amazon, it takes a lot of effort to really do that, to track your sales, to do the advertising and fulfillment, all of that takes a lot of effort. So if I'm an Amazon seller, I look at Walmart and I say, it's going to take me a lot of effort to move to Walmart, and Walmart does not have the same level of consumer penetration as Amazon. Is it really worth it for me to do that? And so a lot of sellers on Amazon choose not to therefore go on Walmart. And so you don't see multi-tenanting happening in that space.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. So I guess that brings us really back to the question of how to operate within a marketplace, if that's what you're doing. And if you're going to sell on in e-commerce, inevitably you get pushed back towards Amazon. There may be other places in different geographical locations. I would just put a shout out for Cdiscount in France, which has, I think, something like about 50% of the number of consumers of Amazon, which is pretty good going for a substantial size country. And the French are traditionally, despite being a part of the EU, which is one of the world's biggest free market experiments, very, very protectionist, ironically, of course, when it comes to their own country. And then the bol.com in the Netherlands, I would argue, is bigger and more successful than Amazon. And I wouldn't dismiss those opportunities if that's a focus, because the profit levels can be great. But, so there are alternatives. But let's say for the moment that we stick with Amazon. One of the things that you mentioned to me when we had a chat about this and how to really be practically helpful to Amazon sellers is the economics of marketplaces are quite different from traditional pricing theory. So I think that's a really critical little tactical, but quite significant for profit point to look at. So tell me about this. How come traditional pricing theory breaks down? I mean, first of all, you better remind us what traditional pricing theory is and then how it works differently.
Yeah, in traditional pricing theory, you sell directly to consumers. And, as you scale, you're able to drive down prices because you have economies of scale. And so the suppliers who have the largest economies of scale generally tend to win out against other suppliers because they can drive down prices. In the marketplace, you know, you have two parties to the transaction going through the marketplace. And so in many situations, like, you know, example of Visa, for example, you know, there's no cost to a consumer to transact with Visa. And then what Visa is able to do is to take the transaction fee that the merchants, you know, provide to Visa, they're able to take a percentage of that and then provide that to the consumers as rewards. So, you know, you can play around with pricing based on who's really paying for the services.
Okay, so let's take a practical example of selling on Amazon. So I guess I always tend to come back to this rather narrow view of the world because that is, you know, our primary listener base that we're trying to serve. So if somebody's selling a widget, let's say it's wooden toys, because I happen to have had a couple of clients, weirdly enough, who've sold wooden toys over time, and they sell on their own direct-to-consumer site, and they do, you know, quite a bit of their revenue there, and they sell on Amazon. They probably do the majority of their revenue there. So how does the pricing work in that sort of scenario?
Yeah, so right now it's pretty straightforward with Amazon. You know, as a seller, you have to take into account, you know, all the fees that Amazon charges, as well as the advertising expense of advertising on Amazon. And then based on the kind of margin that you have, you want to achieve, then you price your products accordingly, take into account what competitors are also charging in the marketplace. But it is indeed possible, going back to the Visa example, for Amazon to establish kind of a rewards program so they can take some of the listing fees that they're charging, you know, to suppliers and provide that to the consumers as rewards. They haven't done so far. They haven't had a need to do so, but that's certainly possible in the future. So that's an example of where, you know, can play around with the transaction dynamics and basically take from one entity and give to the other entity.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you could argue that Amazon does do that to some degree, doesn't it? Because it charges, you know, pretty healthy percentage, assuming that the fulfillment side, you've got FBA, let's say that roughly breaks even or is a slight loss for Amazon, but roughly break even, then they're going to charge the sales commission, and then they're going to charge fulfillment, which we'll assume is break even, and then they're going to charge for advertising, which we all know is the biggest profit center outside of AWS, right? So yeah, so you could argue that they're charging a lot of money for advertising and then spending a lot of it on huge range of consumer benefits, including if you're a Prime member, a lot of Amazon Prime. I was shocked to look at my phone the other day and it reported how many hours of Amazon Prime video I'd watched in the last couple of years. And it's huge. So I'm using that a lot. Plus I order from Prime. So that's one of the things that keeps people as consumers stuck to Amazon. You could very well argue that that's being subsidized by us poor suckers as third party sellers, right? So that's
an excellent point, right?
Yeah.
Some of the benefits being provided to consumers is being subsidized by suppliers. And a lot of it's coming from the advertising dollars that they're making from the different suppliers.
Absolutely. Now, talking of being screwed by Amazon as a third-party seller or suppliers, as you call it, we also touch on one of the sections of your book, which is Marketplace Monopolies and the Abuse of Power. Now, I don't spend too long on this because it does end up with, it feels a bit like one of those political unhelpful discussions where you have conspiracy theories and they may be 100% accurate, but they still, even if they are, doesn't really help you move forward in your life. But we have to be aware, again, of the environment we're operating in, that we are swimming with sharks. So you talk about Amazon as one of the big abusers of power. Let's get ourselves riled up for a bit and then we'll move on to more productive things. Some of the things they've been doing are a bit more subtle than the obvious things. So one of the things that is well known is the whole misappropriation of third-party seller data. That's been discussed a lot. We've discussed that on the podcast. So not so excited about that. One of the things that you mentioned in your book, though, is advertising. So what is Amazon doing to abuse its power as an advertiser, do you think, or in the world of advertising?
Yeah, so, you know, when it comes to, you know, search on Amazon, you know, these days, when you do a search on Amazon, you know, sponsored listings take up huge amount of space. And so, in a sense, they have sold their search positions to third-party sellers who are willing to advertise on Amazon. And as a result of that, a lot of the traffic and the sales volume is being driven to suppliers who are willing to spend money on advertising. And so it becomes a vicious cycle where more and more suppliers are forced into advertising on Amazon. And, you know, the margins obviously are impacted as a result. just so that they can appear high up on the search rankings.
Yeah, and I guess that is not really any different to what Google's done. I suppose it's more obvious that Google's a search engine and that they monetize it by advertising. And I guess the fact that physical products are involved at Amazon complicates that picture. But I would argue that it's very much the same kind of business model, really. It's become the de facto search engine for products. Certainly, if I want to buy something and I haven't got much time, I just look on my Amazon app on my phone. I don't even go in a browser, let alone look at Google. Occasionally, I'm forced to go on Google. It happened to me the other day, and that's an event. It actually is a surprise and unusual because I'm looking for a very particular thing. I conduct a local amateur choir in the evenings, so still keeping my hand in with my music. And they had a very, very particular type of music. So it's a particular edition of a particular work by a particular composer. And I couldn't find it on Amazon. And that's actually pretty unusual. So yes, I guess they are basically becoming Google, which means that they're monetizing the advertising. Now, apart from that, the third-party data thing, I think actually is probably overblown because I don't think Amazon needs to take third-party data and produce private label products when they could, you know, which takes a huge amount of money and risk, capital tied up, when they could just make money from advertising. I'm just saying, I think that's a bigger risk. So the other things they've done, acquisition is an interesting one, isn't it? Because we hear about it from time to time, but it's less of an obvious threat. But when you actually look over the course of, say, 15 years of acquisition activity, it actually does change the consumer landscape, doesn't it? Tell us a bit about Amazon's use of its power in acquisitions, buying other businesses.
Yeah, a good example of that is a company called diapers.com, which was selling diapers to their website. And they came to the notice of Amazon, who was not very successful because of diapers.com. And so they basically, for a couple of months, you know, introduced very low prices for diapers to basically take away the business from diapers.com. And then they were able to force diapers.com to sell their company to Amazon at a much lower price than would have been possible if they're not engaged in price, you know, lowering the prices significantly.
Do you want to grow your Amazon business bigger or faster? I bet you do. If so, a free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find some golden missed opportunities. Generally, I charge at least $150 an hour these days for my time, but this is free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing at least a few $1,000s a month in sales. If you are, just go to myamazonaudit.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit and book in a time and we'll see each other on a Zoom call. That's myamazonaudit.com. Thank you very much for listening and I hope to see you on a call soon. Yeah, it's funny, isn't it, that you would perhaps hope that in a country which created the antitrust legislation, which is a weird thing, it just happens to be a particular legal vehicle, but as I understand it, was there to introduce in America in the early 20th century to stop Standard Oil being effectively a monopoly. But actually, trust, not trust, isn't important. What it really means is trying to keep a non-monopoly marketplace. And actually, nobody seems to have intervened with something as very obvious as that. I seem to remember one story. Can't remember if it was about diapers.com or somebody, maybe it was a Zappos guy, that they actually, Jeff Bezos called the founders into their office and had a meeting with them whilst Amazon was running a promotion that was viciously cutting the prices against them. It's right. A real-time hardcore mafia type negotiation tactics. Was that Zappos? Is that something you've heard of?
I've also heard the same thing happen with Zappos. Zappos was also forced into selling to Amazon because they were engaged in a fierce price war. And Zappos, you know, saw the sales decline considerably and they had to then, investors forced them to sell the company to Amazon.
Yeah. I mean, I guess you could argue that, you know, one of the ways that if you create a small brand to monetize it is simply to sell it. And I suppose if you have to sell it to Amazon, you'll get less money than if you are not forced to sell it. But in one way, I would argue that, you know, it's interesting. I mean, what are your thoughts about this? You've investigated monopolies. I would argue that all markets of all kind tend towards monopoly. I remember reading once in some economics book, not that I read that many economics textbooks, but I am interested in economics. And I think it was from the 1960s, so very much pre-internet. And there was some study that they'd done that all marketplaces tend towards monopoly unless they're highly regulated. Would you agree with that? And how does that sort of tie into this? Do you think there's an acceleration effect from the internet or is it just business as usual?
Well, I think as we discussed before, you know, most marketplaces tend to be a winner-take-all, winner-take-most you know, situation. And as they start abusing their monopoly power, then that catches the attention of, you know, in the case of the U.S., Congress has investigated Amazon significantly, and so has the EU. And so there is going to be action that's going to be taken in the future against entities like Amazon here in the U.S. So I see regulation as happening, something that's going to happen in the future. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, I remember reading in your book about the EU has taken some really quite considerable steps against Amazon, and Amazon's had to sort of agree quite a few compromises, hasn't it, in terms of using its position. Yeah. So assuming for the moment that we don't necessarily trust the governments are going to get it right or do it quickly, if you're a third-party seller on an Amazon marketplace, or for that matter, any other marketplace that you feel, I mean, Google's, if you sell direct to consumer, you're still, you know, beholden to Google and Facebook, you know, to get traffic to your website one way or the other, aren't you? Or somebody like that, even TikTok is effectively a marketplace.
Yeah.
What tactics or what strategies can we put in place to mitigate that effect and to push against that monopolization? And I guess even before we talk about that, what are we even fighting? What are the bad effects for third-party sellers? We talked about advertising as a percentage of your sales getting ever bigger. What are the other effects that having a monopolizing marketplace has on the people who sell on those
markets? Yeah, I mean, it's basically, you know, intense pricing pressure, because there's so many suppliers in Amazon's marketplace that, you know, one, your margins will be impacted because you now spend on advertising. And even if you advertise, there are other players also advertising, and it becomes, you know, a game of pricing and reviews. Those are the two main factors that come into, you know, pricing decisions. So my advice to sellers is to have excellent customer service and basically do everything possible to get, legally, of course, everything possible to get good reviews for your products. And that's ultimately the key decision factor. A lot of Amazon buyers are focused on is looking at reviews and making decisions based on the products.
Yes, we have quite a few. I've got even one episode coming up, which is specifically about how to get reviews and create a sort of really serious machine for getting reviews, not just sending begging emails, which is not a bad idea, but it's not enough these days. So you're quite right. Yeah, the other thing I guess we need to do is within the marketplace, you've got pricing power that pushes downwards if you assume that everybody's commoditized, or they're seen as equal products or equal brands. And I guess the one thing we've got to do is develop a brand, right? So something that sells. For example, I actually bought my current computer, and it's a MacBook Pro, on Amazon. Now, I didn't buy it because it was on Amazon. I bought it because it was by Apple. So that brand, that consumer brand, the product brand, made a difference to my buying decision, was the primary driver of that particular buying decision. So what's your take on that?
Yeah, definitely. And to the extent that you can establish a brand, then you can avoid some of the pricing pressure that you have of selling on Amazon. And part of the brand, again, I keep saying this, is reviews. I know of a seller on Amazon who's done over $15, $20 million of revenues, and he was in the consumer electronics business. And he focused very, very singular focus on reviews. And if anybody had any product, you know, problems with this product, he would just ship them a replacement product. And that's how he got really great reviews and was able to build a strong brand on Amazon. So I think part of the brand is the consumer experience, but part of it is also handling, you know, customer reviews and making sure that you get, you know, over 4.5 stars.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's certainly something we all obsess with getting. And I would just say as well, as a quick shout out to one of the other interviews I've done recently, Bonnie Hall of Senses 8. She's very focused on amazing supplier relationships and great quality control and developing products, you know, with your consumers and also with your suppliers. And I would say that in the end, if you want amazing reviews, you've got to have an amazing product. You have.
Yeah.
To do the homework, right? That is the difference between Google and Amazon, is that there is a product at the other end of it, and it's all within one platform. If you advertise on Google and sell a product on your own direct to consumer website, then is not an immediate feedback loop to getting bad reviews on Google, although it can happen. So yes, absolutely. Well, look, I know that we're going to have a very interesting conversation about the whole how to create your own marketplace question, which is, I think, far more different to the usual questions or thoughts that we have. But have you got any other things that I should have asked you about this area? So for people who are sellers within a marketplace, doesn't have to be Amazon, but anyone who's operating within the marketplace, any other thoughts, any questions I should have asked you?
Yeah, I mean, if you are considering building a marketplace, then one of the things that you have to think about is what kind of fees you're going to charge sellers. And, you know, you have entities like Apple and Google who charge 30%, which is outrageous. And, you know, Etsy and so forth are on the low end of the range. So you have to think very carefully about, you know, what kind of listing fees and what kind of transaction fees you're going to charge. Because the more you charge, the more likely you're going to come get the attention of the regulators. You know, more suppliers are going to be unhappy with you, more disintermediation is going to happen. And so thinking through your pricing strategy is going to be very important.
Yes, that does make sense. Good. All right. So let's just finally ask the obvious question. What services do you offer if somebody's thinking of creating a marketplace startup? How do you help them and how do they contact you?
So people can reach out to me through my website. It's rishnadkarni.com, or they can reach out to me on LinkedIn as well. I accept any connection. And once we're connected, then obviously you can message me. I am very happy to work with entrepreneurs in particular and guide them and potentially invest in good companies as well.
Hey, great. Well, look, and the other thing, of course, is to buy the book, Winner Takes All. Not a huge thick tome. It's a readable thing and nicely split into sections as well. So it's about 170 odd pages. And you can get Winner Takes All if you go to amazingfba.com/winner, WINNER, then you can get a copy of the book as well. Like, I would urge everyone who sells on a marketplace, including everyone who sells on Amazon, to get the book, because I think it gives a very nice overview of how marketplace operates. And if you understand the environment you operate in, you can adjust your behavior from first principles rather than just kind of copying what everyone else is doing. So I think it's a great service to those of us out there who sell on marketplaces. So Shirish Nadkarni, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much.
Do you want to grow your Amazon business bigger or faster? I bet you do. If so, a free audit of your Amazon business can help you see and avoid threats and find some golden missed opportunities. Generally, I charge at least $150 an hour these days for my time, but this is free. You can be a reseller or a brand owner. All I ask is that you're doing at least a few thousand dollars a month in sales. If you are, just go to myamazonaudits.com, scroll down, click on Amazon Audit and book in a time and we'll see each other on a Zoom call. That's myamazonaudit.com. Thank you very much for listening and I hope to see you on a call soon. Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast for six and seven figure Amazon sellers. I really hope you found the show helpful to you. Please don't forget to subscribe to the show. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please do leave us a quick star rating. It will take you all of 30 seconds to do it, but it does mean we can be found by and help many more e-commerce business builders. I wish you fast and profitable scaling. And I hope you enjoy the process of building your seven-figure Amazon business. Thanks very much for listening.